This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mikan Scott.
A massive car bomb exploded outside of a large federal building in downtown Oklahoma City, shattering that building, killing children.
Oklahoma City, take a look at this picture. This is our tower cam shot, a plume of smoke rising in the air.
The bombing in Oklahoma City was an attack on innocent children and defenseless citizens.
It's about half of the building that is literally hanging, and at the bottom two floors are just stacked debris.
For Kathy Sanders, the days after the Oklahoma City bombing were filled with a deep sense of loss and unspeakable grief. Her two grandsons had been killed in the attack on the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building, along with 166 other people. 30 years ago, in April of 1995, Kathy watched as rescue workers swarmed the bomb site, digging through the rubble for survivors. She waited anxiously while federal agents hunted for those responsible. Was this the work of international terrorists? The news that was trickling in suggested otherwise. Kathy was numb with sadness and shock. She invited other family members of victims over for dinner. And that night, another emotion crept in, doubt.
One of the young mothers, Renee Cooper, she said when she dropped her son off that morning and he was killed, she said, "I saw the bomb squad downtown." We didn't believe her.
Why would a bomb squad be there before the bombing had happened? Kathy dismissed the information, but it had planted a seed of distrust. Most of her attention at that time was still captivated by a massive manhunt for John Doe number 2, a man witnesses said they had seen with the main suspect, Timothy McVeigh, who was already in custody.
And then in a matter of weeks, they come out to the FBI, says, "You know what? We made a mistake. There is no John Doe number 2.
Kathy says more things like this kept happening, and leading up to McVeigh's trial, her trust in the investigation faded, as did her husband's.
Now, as I'm watching all this happen, my heart is so broken, I'm dying, but I'm watching my husband's anger. He's mad at McVeigh for blowing up the building, and he's mad at the federal government because he doesn't believe he's been given the truth.
So instead, Kathy took it upon herself to find answers. 30 years later, she's still tracking down evidence and pursuing leads.
Well, I felt like I deserved the truth.
Grant Hill has more on Kathy Sanders' story and what kind of evidence she and other surviving family members are looking for.
On April 19th, 1995, Kathy Sanders woke up and did what had become a favorite part of her daily routine, walked over to the room where her grandson slept to say good morning.
And when I did, I was startled they weren't in their beds. They weren't in there.
Her nerves settled when she found the boys, 2 and 3 years old, fast asleep next to their mom, Kathy's daughter Edie, in the next room over.
When I flipped on the light, I sang, "Good morning to you, good morning to you. We're all in our places with sunshiny faces. What a nice way to start a new Wednesday." And the little boys begin to giggle, and Edie and I begin to get the boys ready for school. And that's where they spent the last night of their lives.
The boys, Chase and Colton, went to daycare at the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City. At 9:02 a.m., Kathy heard a thunderous roar.
Unlike anything I'd ever heard in my life, I knew something really bad had happened.
Kathy and Edie both worked in the same office downtown, just around the corner from the Murrah Building.
I ran down two flights of stairs to my daughter's office, and I opened up the door, and everyone inside her office was lined up looking out the windows trying to figure out what happened. And I said to Edie, "Edie, let's go see." So we ran down to the main lobby, and when we walked out the revolving doors of our building, it was like we entered the Twilight Zone. There were big sheets of plate glass falling down all around us. There wasn't a car one moving in the street.
They saw smoke rising 3 blocks away in the direction where they had just dropped off Chase and Colton.
And I said, "Edie, the babies." She took off running with me on her heels.
They arrived to the south side of the federal building to the sound of three more explosions.
And we looked at the north side of the building, and where the daycare once was nothing but a pancaked pile of rubble. And my daughter fell to her knees and she began to weep, "My babies, my babies." And I knew it was the first time in my daughter's life that she had a problem her mother wasn't going to be able to fix.
Kathy and Edie spent the rest of the morning, as hundreds of other families did, waiting for news. And it came relatively quickly. The worst news: Chase and Colton were dead.
We get home, we don't know what to do. We turn on the TV to continue watching the coverage, and they do a close-up view of a little blue sandal that I'd put on Chase just that morning. And I realized, oh my God, the shoes were literally blown off his feet. One of the fathers of a surviving child, he's there by the hospital bed with his boy, and he said, "You know, we just prayed and asked God for a little boy to hold, and God answered our prayer. Isn't this great?" Well, for us, that was like a kick in the gut.
Kathy knew she'd say the same thing if her grandsons had survived, but they did not. And that made her and her husband ask questions. Questions about God and the nature of good and evil. But soon, other questions emerged about the government, the investigation, and what had really transpired on that horrific day. Those questions started a few days after the bombing, when Kathy organized the dinner at her home for the other families who had lost children at the daycare. And one of the moms mentioned seeing bomb squads downtown in the morning.
We didn't believe her.
It just didn't make sense. Yet the mom insisted.
"How do you know? How do you know it was the bomb squad?" She said they had big blue letters on their jacket. And my husband was incredulous. He went down to the fire department the next day, and he asked the chief, the fire chief, "Did the city know? Was the bomb squad downtown?" The fire chief said, "Oh, absolutely not. Our bomb squad wasn't there."
But it wasn't just that mother. ABC News later found others had also reported seeing bomb squad teams before the attack happened.
"Mention of the bomb squad in this company newsletter, in this inner office article by a county worker, and in a small town newspaper story."
It wasn't long before the fire chief backtracked.
And he said, "You know, I just made a mistake."
It turned out the county did have its bomb squad truck downtown that day. The team was scheduled for routine training, but someone used the truck for unsanctioned stops.
Our guys were just running routine errands and stopped to get a cup of coffee. We didn't know what to believe.
Because to Kathy and her husband, Glenn, that coincidence still did not explain all the other bomb squad sightings downtown that morning. What looked like armed search teams and bomb-sniffing dogs.
"We saw officers going through the bushes and looking in these windows at the bottom of the courthouse here, say no more than seven."
Investigative journalist Andrew Gumbel co-wrote a book on the bombing in 2012. And dug through thousands of pages of records and government reports. He knows how tricky memory can be, especially for those who are asked to recall scenes from what would become a giant media event. But he discovered there might have been something to those sightings. Another bomb squad unit was in Oklahoma City that morning, one from the state, as well as a team from the U.S. military, sent in all the way from New Mexico.
"I never got to the bottom of why they were sent. I've never got to the bottom of what they did, if anything, at what point they were told to go home."
In fact, Andrew says, in the days leading up to the attack, warnings were exchanged between agencies. There was vague chatter that something was up.
"It's not unclear if it was a generalized warning against federal courthouses, if it was a specific warning about Oklahoma City. This we do not know. A lot of those warnings circulate all the time. So, you know, it's important not to attach too much importance to it necessarily."
In the early days after the bombing, Kathy and her family knew none of this yet. But they did know some of the details that were coming out about the perpetrators. By then, authorities already had Timothy McVeigh in custody, the skinny 26-year-old anti-government extremist and white supremacist had been pulled over shortly after the bombing. His getaway car was missing a license plate, and on the passenger seat was a manifesto. Authorities said the bombing itself was not captured by any security cameras that morning, but McVeigh's description also roughly fit that of John Doe Number 1, one of two men who the FBI said rented a moving truck under an assumed name from a body shop in Kansas days earlier. The truck, whose axle was found in the rubble. 2 days after the bombing, an accomplice, Terry Nichols, had turned himself in. Nichols lived in Kansas and had helped load the truck with 2 tons of ammonium nitrate and fuel to build the bomb. But Nichols looked nothing like the other person agents were looking for, John Doe Number 2, an olive-skinned man with long hair and a distinct hat, first seen with McVeigh at the body shop. 2 dozen witnesses said they saw a similar man matching that description with McVeigh in Oklahoma City on the morning of the bombing. So the hunt for this mysterious accomplice continued. Who was he, and what was his role in the attack?
The largest manhunt in American history was going on for John Doe 2.
But not for long.
And then in a matter of weeks, they come out to the FBI, says, you know what, we made a mistake. There is no John Doe Number 2. Well, by this time, we already knew there was over 20 eyewitnesses that had seen McVeigh downtown the morning of the bombing. Many of them described the same dark-skinned man with the tattoo on his arm and the flames on his ball cap that he was wearing. And now they're telling us it was all a mistake. And we're thinking, could 22 people be wrong?
Yes, investigators said. According to the FBI, John Doe Number 2 did not exist. Those witnesses were mistaken. Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols were the only people who caused this bombing. Journalist Andrew Gumbel says prosecutors insisted the case was just that simple, that it had to be.
There was a tremendous amount of pressure from on high, which is to say President Bill Clinton, Janet Reno, the attorney general, who said, you know, we can't lose these cases. We need to get the death penalty. We absolutely have to make sure that there is justice for the, you know, bereaved population of Oklahoma City. And the prosecutors described this to me. You know, they said we couldn't fail. At a certain point in the investigation, they had not been lucky in finding other suspects beyond McVeigh and Nichols. And they decided as a matter of courtroom strategy to focus on them exclusively and to characterize McVeigh in particular as a lone mastermind.
That meant no loose ends, no mysterious, unexplained John Does.
You had this very strong narrative from the federal government, but also from state officials, that McVeigh and the person who was acknowledged to have helped him to build the bomb and to assemble the components, Terry Nichols, were the only two significant players.
In 1997, Kathy and her husband watched prosecutors lay out this narrative in real time at Terry Nichols' federal trial. But the couple had grown jaded by the bomb squad saga. They had no doubt that Terry Nichols was guilty. Still, they listened as his defense attorney poked holes in the idea that he alone collaborated with McVeigh.
Then we learned about the Dreamland Motel where McVeigh stayed the week before the bombing. Well, while he was at the hotel, there were people seen coming and going from his room.
People, investigators said, once again, did not exist. Despite what multiple witnesses had told them, the motel owner, a Chinese food delivery man, and other guests. These seemed like important leads, leads Kathy and her husband thought were simply dismissed rather than disproven.
That was problematic for us. Then we learned that the FBI had gotten good latent fingerprints from McVeigh's car after he was arrested and from the Dreamland Motel. And when we learned, FBI agent said on the witness stand, no, I took all these prints, but I didn't run them through the computers for a check. And the defense attorneys were like, well, why in the world wouldn't you? And he very sheepishly said, well, it wouldn't be cost effective.
Why was the FBI letting so many leads go? So many other potential suspects who might have been implicated. She asked this to one of the lead agents who sat next to her in court.
He patted me on the shoulder and he said, don't worry, Kathy, We don't want to give the defense teams any ammunition to point the finger anywhere else. We want to get these two convicted, and then we're going to go after the others. They never went after the others.
Before the trial ended, less than 2 years after the bombing, Kathy's husband, Glenn, died of pancreatic cancer. He was 47.
I learned from watching Glenn that harboring bitterness and anger and hatred in your hearts like drinking poison and expecting the enemy to die.
Now, Kathy sat alone in the courtroom, searching for the answers her husband would never know. And her heart started to break for someone else, Terry Nichols' mom.
I realized, you know, she's the forgotten victim. What a horrible thing that her son got so messed up in. And it wasn't long after I befriended her, we began to eat together in the courtroom, eat lunch together, and we sat together in the courtroom. And Terry Nichols, the bomber, became my friend Joyce's son.
She never forgot that Joyce's son was a terrorist who helped build the bomb that killed her grandsons. But she started to see him differently, not as a monster, as a person who did something monstrous. If others had helped him pull it off, they should at least be treated like he was. A third man, Michael Fortier, eventually did admit to knowing about the plot, but he struck a deal with the feds, testified against Nichols and McVeigh in exchange for only 12 years of prison time and his eventual disappearance into the Federal Witness Protection Program. For the prosecutors, his testimony was fruitful. Nichols was found guilty on one count of conspiracy and 8 counts of involuntary manslaughter. Unlike Timothy McVeigh, he was spared the death penalty and sentenced to life without parole.
The jury forewoman got on TV and she said, "We know Nichols is guilty, but we don't know how guilty." So that left me with a lot of questions. The trials came and went. I went back home. I got a letter in the mail, and it was from Terry Nichols. And I thought, Lord, I don't want, I'm not looking for a pen pal. And if it was, I wouldn't be the Oklahoma City bomber. And then I thought, well, who's going to know more about the bombing than the bomber? So I was willing to dance with the devil to get to the truth. I began to write to Terry.
Soon, he asked Kathy for her number. He said he wanted to speak with her.
So I gave him my phone number and we began to talk on the phone. And the phone calls were just 15 minutes long, but he could call several times when he was at the county jail. I mean, soft-spoken. You would never think that the man would have done something so horrific. And probably had he never met Timothy McVeigh, he wouldn't have done anything. And then I began to go up to the jail to see him.
In 2004, Nichols was being held close to where Kathy lived, awaiting his trial on state charges. A final shot for the people of Oklahoma to sentence him to death.
Did I forgive Terry Nichols? Yes, I have. Do I think he should be punished? Yes, I do. Forgiveness and punishment are two different things, but I have a friendship with him.
Nichols did not want to die. Kathy said he told her that once his trial was over, once the death penalty was not hanging over his head, he'd tell her everything he knew about the plot, what he remembered about who was involved. And soon, it seemed like that day had come. Nichols was found guilty on all of the state charges. But again, the jury could not come to a unanimous decision on the death penalty. The rest of his life would be spent at a federal maximum security prison in Colorado, where he agreed to let Kathy interview him for a segment that would air on CBS's 60 Minutes. He told Kathy he trusted her more than any journalist. The story was supposed to be a follow-up to the show's interview with Timothy McVeigh 5 years before. But then Kathy got a letter from the warden. Her request to meet with Terry Nichols was denied because, the warden said, it, quote, could pose a risk to the internal security of the prison and to the staff, inmates, and members of the public.
Now, Florence, Colorado is the prison that houses the worst criminals in America. How could I possibly be a threat to them? So they wouldn't allow it.
Eventually, Kathy said she got word from Terry Nichols' mother, Joyce, that she was taken off of his call list, too. Ever since, Kathy and Nichols have written to one another knowing their letters are screened, unsure whether their full correspondence really gets through. And Kathy's search for answers has continued. She wants to know if there were others who helped McVeigh and Nichols pull off the bombing. She also wonders about the involvement of undercover federal agents, people who might have tipped off those bomb squad teams a little too late.
Well, I felt like my husband and that my grandchildren deserved the truth. So I've continued the investigation over all of these years.
She's collected her own statements, asked her own questions, keeps her own archive, and helps journalists when they come calling. Journalists like Andrew Gumbel, who started to write his book on the bombing in 2001.
And when I came along in 2001, she'd been at it for 6 years and was able to introduce me to a number of people. That was my starting point.
It was a starting point that eventually led Andrew and his co-author to access the full discovery file that the government had handed over to Terry Nichols' defense team at trial, something no journalist had ever seen before. And the file posed more questions than it answered, including one extremely confounding question, something Timothy McVeigh's lawyer made a lot of noise about during his trial. Not those witness statements or a lack of security camera footage, but a physical piece of evidence called P-71.
So what happened was that about a month after the bombing, there was a federal agent who found this extra leg in the rubble.
A left leg with a military boot attached to it.
And in those days, there was no systematic DNA screening of body parts because it took a long time. And so, you know, the forensics experts had to pick and choose, you know, what DNA are we going to test? What DNA are we not going to test? So there was no immediate answer to who the leg belonged to.
Andrew says it soon became apparent that the leg belonged to a 21-year-old Air Force cadet who was killed in the attack. She had stopped into the federal building to get a social security card for her baby.
Lakeisha Levy, who in the meantime had been buried in her hometown in New Orleans. A decision was made to exhume Lakeisha Levy's body, and they confirmed, first of all, that the leg in the rubble belonged to her, but she had been buried with a different left leg. So then the question was, who did that belong to?
Maybe that leg belonged to John Doe number 2, or any other conspirator who may have been killed in the blast. At trial, McVeigh's lawyer argued the leg suggested the presence of another bomber. Prosecutors said it likely belonged to one of 8 victims buried without a leg. Andrew's sources in the FBI told him they were really confident about this theory, that they had even narrowed it down to a single victim. But the only thing that would settle the dispute was a DNA profile, a sample that could either be matched to a victim or identified as an unknown suspect. Unfortunately, the state medical examiner testified that his office was unable to obtain a DNA profile from the leg because it had already been embalmed. Decades later, however, in 2015, that same office told a local news outlet something different. The office did obtain a DNA profile of that leg after all, and it did not match any of the victims it was tested against. Nor was this DNA profile ever provided to defense teams. This extra leg has bothered Kathy Sanders since she first found out about it during the trials.
Because they don't know who it is. It could be a bomber. We don't know.
Terry Nichols also seemed to think it was potentially crucial. If you really want to get to the bottom of the OKC bombing, he wrote to Kathy in one letter, then do a genealogy test on that leg. Nichols wanted to apply modern science to crack the case, forensic genetic genealogy. It was the same technique that led to the apprehension of the Golden State Killer in 2018. Using public DNA databases built from consumer ancestry kits to identify a suspect's relatives based on their DNA profile, Kathy had the same idea. So recently, she called up the medical examiner's office and asked for a copy of that DNA profile.
I said, well, I'd like a copy of it. Oh, well, I'm sorry, I can't share that with you.
She filed a formal request and received the same response.
If there's nothing to worry about P71, then let's do the DNA, you know? If you've got the science and aren't allowed to use it, then you're just up a creek.
The office apologized, saying legally their hands were tied. According to the law, the only person who could order that kind of testing was an interested party in the case. Someone like a defendant. Someone like Kathy's unlikely ally, Terry Nichols.
I'm in the process now of working with an attorney, and I'm taking some new steps that I can't talk about right now, but I'm not giving up. It's been 30 years, and I'm going to find out who that leg belonged to.
Kathy has spent 3 decades collecting evidence, looking for truth. She's written books about forgiveness and healing and participated in documentaries about her hunt for more evidence. Her most recent book came out this year, Shadows of Conspiracy, The Untold Story of the Oklahoma City Bombing. Kathy says she won't rest until she feels like all of the evidence has been reviewed and acknowledged, and until she feels like the story of the bombing is complete and true.
That story was reported by Grant Hill.